Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Okay, welcome to another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. Before we get started, I want to say that something has happened that I never thought was going to happen, which is we reached our one-year anniversary. We started this thing as a total lark. I kind of expected, because I'm a pessimist, that we would fizzle out and die pretty quickly, but that has not happened, thanks to you, everybody who's listening. I'm incredibly grateful that you continue to listen and, you know, write little reviews once in a while and give us good ratings and all that. So keep doing that, please, and just know that I'm really grateful to you and also extremely grateful to the people who've come on and been our guests and all the folks who do the work behind the scenes here at ABC News. So I'll stop gushing, but please know that I'm really psyched that we're at this year point and hopefully many more years to come. So this week's episode comes from the cross-country meditation tour that we did not long ago, where we got that ridiculous bus and drove across the country and talked to all sorts of meditators and wannabe meditators and jacked up meditators, et cetera, et cetera. And on this stop in the trip, we stopped at a really counterintuitive place, the Virginia Military Institute, where you would not think they would be doing meditation, but they are. And this is one of these episodes where it's going to be co-hosted by me and my friend and man crush, Jeff Warren. Jeff Warren is one of my favorite meditation teachers in the world, and he and I went on this cross-country trip together. And so it's interesting to be at VMI because neither of us is eligible to serve in the military. He, because he's Canadian, and me, because I'm old and I have a checkered past. But the folks that we're going to talk to, or that we did talk to and that you will now hear from, are qualified to serve, and they are Professor Matt Jarman and Professor Holly Richardson, and they're both doing incredibly interesting work at VMI with the cadets. So here you are. Enjoy Professors Jarman and Richardson. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome.
Matt, let me just start with you. Just describe for us, if you would, what you do.
So I'm a psychology professor. I'm in the psychology department, and I teach leadership class, and this semester I've started a new class called Modern Warriorship, and in that class we're essentially teaching them to be warriors, which is to say to be mentally and physically prepared to help others, and meditation is the key mental tool that we're using for that.
Do you think when students sign up for Modern Warriorship, they think you're going to teach them to meditate?
I do mention it in the course description, just in case that might turn them off, but it doesn't seem to phase people.
Really?
Well.
Yeah. Doesn't?
Yeah.
No. Interesting.
Yeah. I'm very receptive.
And Holly?
Yeah.
What's your role here?
Yeah, I'm in physical education, and I teach a mindfulness class. This is the second semester of our mindfulness class. We follow the curriculum of what they're doing in UMass, Massachusetts Medical School.
Just to explain that to folks, that's where they really invented mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Right.
Invented by this towering figure, I think, in American life, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a molecular biologist who really came up with a version of meditation that stripped out the metaphysical claims and the religious practices and just gave you the mindfulness.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the curriculum that we're following, his curriculum. So we've had a class this fall. We have a second class this spring, so we're excited to bring this to VMI.
So I have so many questions about how this goes down here, but I want to start just by drawing out a little of your personal story. So, Matt, how did you start meditating?
It started in graduate school. I took a course that was essentially about meditation and mindfulness. And I started there, and right even before the class, I read one of the optional readings and kind of was hooked. I had always been looking for kind of how to be more productive and effective kind of mentally, and this seemed like the perfect tool for that.
And do you have a military background?
No.
Okay, so you can teach here and get the outfit without actually having served in the military.
Right. Most faculty are not have military background, but most full-time faculty are in uniform and they receive a rank and the Virginia militia,
right?
And so it's kind of more to enable the tradition, the military tradition, to continue, so that they can be in that military environment.
What about it? What about the practice of meditation? Why did you feel you needed it? What was going on in your life?
I think it was always just the search for how can I be more productive and efficient, and decrease stress, increase concentration, and this seemed to do that. I mean, graduate school was the thing that was going on, you know. And,
so you weren't looking to commune with the cosmos per se. It was really
just kind of how can I be as kind of optimally functioning as possible in terms of just getting work done, and this has done it for me. Mm-hmm.
How would you say it's done it for you?
I find that I'm far more mentally efficient in terms of doing my work and productive when I meditate. I meditate daily largely because I know if I don't, I won't be nearly as productive or good at what I'm doing.
Do you think it helps you stay on task? The exercise of trying to focus on one thing, I would imagine your breath, and then getting lost, starting again, it just really helps, it trains the mind to be right there with what you're, with whatever task you're trying to perform.
Right, yeah. So I'm much less kind of scattered, you know, and if I do find that at the end of the day I'm kind of tired and depleted but still need to do some work, then I'll do another short meditation session, kind of replenish that and get back to work.
And Holly, what about you? How did you?
Yeah, as an undergrad, I was taught transcendental meditation and did that for a few years and kind of walked away from it, fell out of that practice. And then about 3 years ago, I began reading Jon Kabat-Zinn and taking a look at the brain research of the possibilities of mindfulness. So I've come back to it, and my practice is now steady. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it to VMI, that I was getting benefits. I was reading about soldiers being deployed and coming back from deployment, and how mindfulness does, in fact, studies suggest that there's really good evidence that this is a tool that they can use to help with post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the challenges they come back with.
What did it do for you personally? Why did you want it?
Well, at first, I think when I was 20, I probably wanted to see Nirvana. But decades later, I felt like I was a bit more, I was reactive to things. I was kind of losing my cool a little bit more than I wanted to, and started again. It's really helped calm me, focus me. I laugh more. I feel like I am a more authentic person because of that meditation practice.
Wow. And do you have a military background?
No. I'm a citizen soldier, so technically we're in the military, the Virginia military militia, but we are civilians.
And so how did it go down? I'd be interested to hear from both of you, but let me start with you. When you came to this environment and said, all right, let's meditate, how did people react to that?
Well, carefully. So I guess the great news is there's so much research out there, and the brain research that really gives evidence that this does change the brain. It does help. And this environment for the cadets, stress is endemic. It's pervasive. And so when I first got here, I was very concerned about the welfare of cadets, as other faculty are. And I just realized stress will be here. It will be here in the cadet's life. So I flipped the way I was looking at the cadet's health, and I thought about mindfulness and bringing that tool to the cadets so they could withstand their first year here, or as a senior, they, you know, have the wherewithal and kind of the sense of peace of getting everything done they need to graduate. So it was kind of a roundabout way that I felt like students could benefit.
And Matt, what about you? Did you get funny looks when you said, hey, I want to teach meditation?
So I teach a leadership course that's required of all cadets, regardless of major. So I had a kind of mix of of majors, and in that leadership course, I wanted to have a meditation component, but I was worried about how they would react. So at first I just called it mind fit training, kind of attention training, which is in some ways a more accurate description of what they're doing, you know, in terms of its outcomes. And I didn't mention meditation. I got no resistance. And then I realized that they didn't really care. Like there was, so from then, from after that first semester, I've just called it meditation and I've gotten no resistance
really?
At all. None. Mm-hmm. And many people report finding a lot of benefit from it. I offered they can do it as extra credit, and you know, some choose to do it, and those who do often report benefits. And now that I'm teaching the modern warriorship, you know, they maybe knew a little bit more that they were what they were getting into, but still, no resistance.
They knew they were taking a course with the weird professor. So
right, yeah, I guess, yeah, the guy who does yeah. the meditation yeah. stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to jump in here at all?
Yeah, I'm interested in what you said about the post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. some of the research that it's showing there. And I'm wondering if you've had, you know, through here, there's been any more discussions around that, or and how you think about that piece.
That's a great question. And in the mindfulness class, we talk about different populations that could benefit. And so we spend a fair amount of time with post-traumatic stress, what it is, and how the application of mindfulness for that that diagnosis. Certainly the cadets, I would say most all cadets are aware of post-traumatic. We've had in the past veterans return being redeployed from VMI. So it's on people's mind, not so much now, but certainly 7, 8 years ago. So again, they know it, and some have experienced it.
Yeah, just how do you think it helps? Like, what do you think is going on in the meditation itself that actually can make that difference? I have some thoughts too, but I'm just wondering how you frame it.
Right. So in terms of the signs and symptoms of that post-traumatic stress disorder, it allows that individual to become present, become still, present, aware of a small thing as the breath can change that mindset of that individual who is challenged with post-traumatic. Mm. So I think it's switching the channel, so to speak, and the switching the mindset of, you know, the video of being back in conflict and realizing, no, I'm here, mm-hmm. I have my breath, mm-hmm. I'm okay. So I mm-hmm. think that's certainly the first and immediate thing that happens. And then again, in terms of being more relaxed, less reactive, in terms of their emotions, kind of dampening down that, I guess, the highs and the lows, kind of bringing those together. So I think that's certainly our benefits that have been out there and that soldiers have used.
It's amazing because you can apply it after the fact, after they've been in combat, after they've had those experiences, but you can also apply it before the fact. You know, you can begin to do that training, which prepares you in the terms of the resilience. Yeah.
Absolutely, and I guess that's the beauty of it in terms of deployment, reapployment, but and everybody has the capability of doing this, you know, in terms of breathing and meditating. It's the practice that is challenging.
And also, I mean, there's recent research looking at how meditation practice in soldiers pre-deployment can teach them skills, cognitive resilience, so that they are, you know, less affected in these negative ways afterwards. One issue that's been brought up is that there's a the military often uses stress inoculation, or they'll put you in stressful situations, and that depletes the kind of resources you need to deal with stress. And then you go out and you're depleted and you're in a stressful situation. So if you combine meditation practice, and if you combine the mental fitness component, it kind of acts as a buffer and helps you, so you can benefit as much as possible from that stress inoculation, because that can be valuable, but also giving you the tool to kind of replenish those resources so that hopefully you don't get to the PTSD point. Mm.
And so you see that resilience building up, and you've seen it in your students?
It'll be exciting to take a look at the student evaluations where came back to they are using this practice from their course. We have a member of the rifle team, and she uses it during her rifle team practice, but also in competitions. So, we're seeing it being used, and we talk about just many seconds where if they have to go in and see the commandant for maybe a demerit or punishment, that again they have their breath, they have that presence of breathing 3-5 times, going in and having a more productive conversation with someone who's handing out punishment or demerits.
What is the focus of your research, and can you talk a little bit about more about what modern warriorship means and the role of mindfulness within that?
Yeah, sure. So in the past, I've looked at things related to problem solving, creativity, also to psychological well-being, and also social change. I'm very interested in change, in creating social change, and the cognitive processes that within people, and then the social processes and all the things that produce kind of desirable social change. And so from my perspective, a warrior is one who creates change of some sort. The root, the kind of, you can trace the word war to kind of creating disorder and change. And so essentially you're changing some undesirable process, right? Mm-hmm. And so that can be in a military context, but the way I'm thinking about it, it can also be in the business sector, even at home, if it's creating some sort of change in a process for the benefit of others. So it has a helping component as well. And warriorship, the way I'm talking about it, is the mental and physical training, the discipline training, to allow you to be a more effective warrior, to allow you to be mentally and physically ready and able when the time comes to help others, whether it's kind of this systematic kind of, if you're leading a big change in an organization, or if it's just helping someone who needs help on the street all of a sudden, but being mentally and physically ready for that.
But is your broader definition culturally acceptable within the military? Because sometimes you hear people in the military describe their essential job as killing people and blowing things up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I don't know if people might have different definitions of warriorship. I think that there's often discussion of is it ethical to train to teach meditation practice to people who might be killing others? Is that ethically sound? From my perspective, if you're more mentally and physically kind of, the mental training allows you to be better at making decisions, acting quickly, reaction times. So in my mind, it allows you to do your job better, which hopefully results in as few casualties as possible. So I'd rather, if someone is in a profession that requires that sort of action, that they be as mentally sound as possible.
Yeah, I spent some time with a woman who was training Marines to meditate, and she said she had taken a lot of blowback from traditional Buddhists saying, you're making better baby killers. And she said, no, I'm making people who kill fewer babies.
Mm. Right. Mm. Right.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest obstacle that your cadets face in either starting meditation or maintaining it?
I think, in general, one of the biggest challenges to any new practice, which is why people, constantly fail at New Year's resolutions and things like that. In the research, you look at habit formation, and there are certain conditions under which you're more likely to form a habit. Research shows, for example, that we have a resolution, right? We have this intention at the beginning of the year to do something. Let's say it's meditation. Research shows, though, that even the brain kind of structures that are responsible for intention are different from those that govern habitual action. So just because you have the intention to do something doesn't mean it's going to become a habit. And in fact, whether it becomes a habit has to do with kind of contextual cues. You know, if you want to meditate, but it's extremely inconvenient to meditate, you don't have the space set up, you don't know when you're going to do it, even if you really want to, it's not going to happen. So one of the first topics that we discussed in my class was research on habit formation and how do we do that. So identifying some kind of contextual cue that occurs regularly that you kind of pair that habit with. So, for example, my cadets, they will meditate in the morning for a 15-minute period, and then also 5 minutes of meditation right before they do start getting to work on homework. Because I figure, what's something that they do every day? They have to do work at some point, right? So if they can tie the meditation to that, then hopefully even when they leave this class, that'll still be a cue that'll prompt this behavior. And the key piece with habit is, if it is a habit, habits don't require you to exert willpower, right? Because you just do it, right? So people think, you know, it takes a lot of willpower to start to do this new practice like meditation. Well, once it becomes a habit, it doesn't take any extra willpower, right? So that's the key. We need to make it a habit, because otherwise you're constantly having to exert this willpower to make yourself do something that is difficult, right? So we're trying to make it not so difficult and just kind of automatic.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
What else can you say more about habit formation? What other useful tips and tricks have you ferreted it out?
In the research they talk about, the key pieces are, you know, habit formation requires some repetitive act. It requires contextual cues. They can be a particular time of day. It can be a particular environment you're in, people you speak to, and then an intermittent reward is ideal, because the goal is that the habit be kind of intrinsically motivated. You're not doing it just for some reward, you know. So it's like slot machines. Right? You don't get payback every time, right? So it's that intermittent reward that kind of, you're not doing it for the money, you're doing it for the game, because you don't get the money every time. So that can't be extrinsically motivated so much, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So with meditation, for example, I think the rewards are inherently a little bit intermittent. You know, after some meditations, I feel, wow, I'm in the zone, I'm productive, right? And others, you know, I feel more calm, but, you know, just, you know. And so those kind of big changes in my ability to perform are somewhat intermittent. So that kind of satisfies that requirement. And then, you know, creating, I do it at a particular time of day. And then also one good strategy is, if you have an existing habit, you can tie it,
link it
to that.
Yeah, which
is where the homework comes
right.
from.
And
they
right.
do the homework,
right.
just tie it to that, and then you're good.
Did you have something to add?
Yeah, this is absolutely fascinating. I think a lot about this too. And when I look at friends of mine, students, and who successfully have a meditation practice, it's because it's become automated. You know,
right.
they just roll out of bed. This is the time they do it. They think of it as brushing their teeth or something. It's
right.
just they've made it into a habit. But you said something really interesting, and I think I want to just make sure I understood it. which is that actually intermittent reward of meditation is part of what might make it work as a habit, in the sense that you sometimes there's a feeling of it being, wow, I feel phenomenal, I feel really great. But other times you meditate and you might still feel a little bit scattered, or it's not like a perfect guarantee all the time. But are you saying that intermittency actually can be part of helps it be a practice people stay with?
Yes, in some ways.
I've never thought about that.
Yeah, that's my understanding of the research. Basically, they're saying, because yeah, if it were only for those kind of, you know, amazing benefits for meditation, then, you know, if you didn't have them a few times, then you'd stop, right? Because why are you doing it then? But if you know that it's intermittent, then you know you're not going to stop if there are a few meditation sessions where your mind still feels scattered.
Yeah. No, that's so important. I mean, it's such an important principle to teach, to give people, let people understand the big picture of a practice is that it's not going to be all, you know, unicorns and roses every day. Right. It may never be that.
Right.
But even like the really nice, juicy feeling absorbed and feeling calm. There's an analogy that one teacher uses that he says he compares it to exercise, or he compares it to running. And he says, you know, in running, there's the reason you're doing it, which is better cardiovascular health, but then there's the effects of running. And sometimes you might go running and feel invigorated. Other times you feel breathless and exhausted. Other times you feel in pain. Every run, you're building towards better cardiovascular health.
Sure.
So you can't depend on the actual effect of what's happening in the run to tell you anything about whether you're getting that result. And it's the same with kind of meditation.
Right.
You can have these wonderful experiences, but really you're doing it for better sort of social, you know, psycho, mental, emotional health.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because for me personally, I don't judge the quality of my practice, or try not to judge the quality of my practice based on the quality of my last sit. Mm. I base it on, like, am I less of an idiot overall? And that is, I think, that's the reward for me that I continue to get from it, and that's why I keep doing it.
And so what do your students say about if they try to articulate the reward overall, you know, the kind of how they see it changing them, what do they say, what do you hear?
Well, I think that the students in my class would go back to just something that had happened in the day, just an incident with a roommate or, again, the commandant, or just being able to step back and not be on that treadmill of what if, that they do see practical applications in their life. But I also kind of work them toward some place in their life that they want to have a more authentic presence with, or less stress with, or, you know, to have them think about a purpose, as, you know, narrowing it down to a specific need that they themselves have. And then apply that practice in a specific way and let that practice grow for the kind of overall mind-body benefits.
Oh,
so
that's
one philosophy.
Can you give an example that comes to mind of that, of where...
Yeah, so it was interesting. The class that I taught, we had a number of different cadets. We had commissioning cadets, we had seniors, we had athletes, and the athletes certainly use it before a game or before a practice, and their journals, and I have them journal. And regarding their reflection on that practice, which again helps to, I think, maintain that, to let them see just maybe the ups and downs of that practice. And it may not be mind blowing one day, but that they're more focused on the game, or they take the coach's criticism or positive feedback in a better way. So I think that with the cadets that I have, it's they want specific things to happen, but also I kind of introduce those practices for that reason.
So the guiding, the core of our mission on this little road trip we're doing here is to try to figure out what's stopping people from meditating or what's messing up their practice. You mentioned before just the obstacle of setting up a habit. What else is there? What else do you think gets in the way of people starting, in this context here, a meditation practice?
I think, I mean, you know, you have to, we tend to focus on the person when we ask why isn't this person doing something, but, you know, you have to also have to take into consideration their environment, and, you know, some cadets tell me that, you know, their roommates kind of make fun of them, you know, just kind of in a friendly manner, but they also say they ignore it. And so that's one thing, or even just, you know, the fact that others may not be doing it, and even if it's not kind of against that, it's still not, you know, environment that's really encouraging it, which is why that habit formation and kind of creating the habit is so critical, because without that, you know, and there's just so many other activities here, and here in particular, their time is very structured, and they're very, very busy, which is why I try to explain that, you know, meditation is not, you shouldn't view it as, you know, losing time by meditating. It makes you so much more mentally productive and efficient that you're actually gaining time.
But what do you say to people who say, oh, people are going to make fun of me and think I'm weird if I do this thing? Mm-hmm. Right. What's the practical advice you give those folks?
Well, in a modern warriorship context, I actually just had this conversation with them yesterday. Part of kind of being someone who is preparing to kind of make change, you know, when change is necessary, it means that you're going to be going against a lot of people. So I view that as wonderful practice. So, you know, if you can't do something as simple as meditating and be okay with the fact that others might think it's a little weird, then, you know, then you know, you're not really getting into the training yet. So I actually am going to be having them do stuff that will make them uncomfortable.
I love how you're turning that around, because they're worried that they're going to be called a wuss if they meditate, and you're saying, no, actually, you're a wuss if you don't.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, if you can't meditate and deal with the fact that they're, you know, it's such a minimal threat as far as, you know, on the grand scale.
Yeah, part of being a warrior is going against the stream.
Right, exactly. So that's just one other opportunity to practice going against the stream.
What about for you? I haven't let you weigh in on this issue at all, which is, like, what do you think of the cadets you're dealing with? What are the major obstacles to actually doing this practice? There's a great quote from this guy who we're going to talk to later on our road trip, who says, we know the medicine works, we just can't achieve compliance.
I think the cadets would tell you, I don't have time. I don't have time throughout the day to start a practice. First of all, they need to know how to. So I think, you know, courses are so important. You know, basic mindfulness, 15 weeks, 10 weeks. I think that's critical to have an instructor really setting the stage and providing evidence that this can help. And the practice, taking the group through that practice, but also requiring, as simple as it may seem, homework in terms of coming back, reflecting on that, and putting that part of your practice. So I would say time, this image of I don't have time, and then also, again, I guess, the misunderstanding of what is it? What is mindfulness? And then I think another important part is just role models. Having role models, having populations that they can look to or look toward and say, gosh, you know, I didn't know that coach meditated. I didn't know, you know, the Marines were some of the first to adopt that tool. So it's giving them context. And
so who do you point to? You point to some of the coaches on campus, or the Marines are doing it, or who else do you point
athletes.
To? Athletes.
Yes, I would say athletes, pro athletes. Again, there are a number of faculty and staff who have been deployed that have come back and they practice. So They are great guest speakers. So people that the cadets see as someone they'd like to emulate. So I think that's important.
And in terms of, you know, we've been sort of trying to taxonomize we call them the secret fears that stop people from meditating. We may have a new one or a new way to frame one of them, which is that people are going to think I'm weird if I do this. Yeah. And that seems to be the big fear, or one of the big fears here. And these guys have come up with ways to you know, one, if you know, to reframe it as like, you know, if you're actually going to be mentally tough, you need to be able to withstand that peer pressure. And two, look, there are tons of tough, not weird folks who are doing this. Yeah. You can do it too.
Absolutely. And I was thrilled when one of the central administrators showed up at our mindfulness meditation. It's like, yes, you know. So, you know, he does it. He bought into it. You know, and he's a tough soldier. So,
I have a question based on something you guys said, which is, you know, we're acknowledging that there's a kind of warrior spirit in going against the stream, and that can really help.
What do you mean by going against the stream?
So that's a classic term in which is used in Buddhism. They say the momentum of everyday life is to just continue tumbling along unheeding, just to go along, to kind of keep ratcheting it up, to actually stop and pause and take stock of your life and decide to not go along with that is considered to be going against the momentum of the culture. Mm. So there's something kind of inherently, there is a warrior quality to that, very much. So I think that's really important to emphasize. But at the same time, the reason it's hard to do is because all of the contextual cues from the environment are to say, don't do it, you know, or this is not important. So to have a kind of environmental wrapper where it's okay is quite important. That's what people say about having a community to sit with, for example. That once a week you can sit with the community and it kind of normalizes it. Mm-hmm. So do you have anything you're doing in around that, like a kind of regular weekly meditation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Holly and I are coordinating a mindfulness meditation thing twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, for 40 minutes, open to faculty, staff, and students. So people are welcome to come. We'll offer instruction if they need it, and we'll meditate.
Isn't there a quality of warriorship though to the actual practice? You are you are facing the insane torrent of your own mind, and you're willing to sit there and deal with it. And every time you get lost in the chaos, you're like, oh, I notice I'm lost, and start again. That takes a spirit of warriorship, as you define it.
Right. And there are many meditation traditions that will talk about how, you know, meditation isn't this soft, kind of fluffy thing. You know, you're facing your fears, you're facing your stresses head on, you're kind of leaning into them. And it's giving you the tools to do that more effectively and to not be kind of swept away by them. But it certainly involves that process. And so in some ways, there's the idea that to be best able to help others, you need to first help yourself. And that even that requires, you know, this acts of kind of warriorship.
I love that you emphasize that, because that's something that's so refreshing to hear. I think one of the criticisms of meditation is somehow that it's self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. To frame it as actually, it's sanity to be able to help yourself become more efficient in helping others. Right. You know, you get clearer and saner, and then out of there, that's where you extend your helping hand, and it'll be much more effective in that.
Exactly. Well, and it brings up a tradition of mindful kindness, you know, loving kindness meditation, in terms of different mantras or different phrases that we all could teach people, or certainly instructors. Mm-hmm. So there are different lines and menus that you could pull to really pull out that compassionate warrior, I guess.
Let me just jump in and define that for some folks may not know what loving kindness meditation is. It sounds hopelessly syrupy, and I was deeply resistant to it when I first heard about it. And it actually, in practice, I often describe it as Valentine's Day with a machete to your throat, because you basically are sitting there envisioning a succession of people you love, people you have problems with, people you don't even know, and you're systematically sending them good vibes. And I think a lot of skeptics would be like, that sounds pretty annoying. But actually, there's a significant amount of science that suggests that not only does it have a lot of health benefits, but it can actually change the way you are in the world. Sure. So I wonder, given what you just heard about my skepticism about loving kindness meditation, how do you introduce it at Virginia Military Institute?
Very carefully. Very carefully. I must admit, I haven't tried the loving kindness with cadets. I have tried a mantra that Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thich Nhat Hanh is a famous Vietnamese Zen master.
Yeah, yeah. And just the simple, I'm at peace. You know, I am still. I am here. So, that's as close as I've gotten to loving kindness, to confess. But that's I bring that into my practice, and it's helped. So we'll see if I can go against the grain to bring that type of meditation here.
Just bringing it back before I'm sensitive to your time. So as we head toward the conclusion of this. Just to bring it back to our mission here, which is really to ferret out what are these, as we call them, secret fears that are stopping people from meditating. I wonder, you didn't raise this, so it may not be an issue, but one of the things that was an obstacle for me, and we hear this at the 10% Happier app company that we have, we hear this from people, from customers, which is a fear that meditating might erode your edge. And especially in a military atmosphere, you have to be tough, you know, and your job ultimately may be to go out and kill people and blow things up, that if you meditate, you might become too soft to actually do that or to compete against your peers. Is that something that either of you has encountered?
I really haven't.
Really?
Yeah, that's so
interesting.
I would look at it a different way.
Okay.
That you have that focus. You have a pinpointed kind of focus, like an arrow. That's how I see that in terms of not so much losing your edge, but really focusing that edge. Just like focusing that edge to what you do, whether it's warfare or Wall Street. So I would I might disagree with. Some of that.
Oh, well, I totally disagree with it. It's just a secret. I mean, our whole mission is to identify clearly what the psychologies are at work that are preventing people from doing this thing that would probably be good for them and to knock them down.
Yeah.
I don't think it reduces your edge, but I think it is a fear out there. Yes.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's probably a fear more that people have who are not, don't really know what meditation is.
Yeah.
Right? So that's one of the problems, the baggage that the word meditation has.
Yeah.
So, I never just talk about meditation without first explaining, all the kind of the rationale and what it's doing. And so I think if people realize that it's, honing their attention and their mind, then how can you think that would, how could that possibly get you to lose your edge?
Yeah.
So I think understanding of the meditation practice and its goals is critical. And I always explain that there are different types of meditation with different objectives. This one has this objective, and so I think that helps.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
really,
you.
Really great to sit and talk with you. Really appreciate it. We're going to actually spend some time with some cadets as the day proceeds.
So should we try to slip in some covert loving kindness somehow?
Yeah, that would be,
if I should even risk this.
Yeah.
I might get hit with a bayonet.
Self-compassion practice.
Yeah.
I'll just get them to visualize Dan in a robe with a blow dryer blowing his hair back, sitting down on a ribbon of love.
I like that image.
Okay, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please make sure to subscribe, rate us. And if you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. I also want to thank heartily the people who produce this podcast and really do pretty much all the work. Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.